Okay, Parshas Korach is focused on a theme which represents itself as a mitzvah to us, at least one form or another, and is extremely relevant as we proceed towards the 3 weeks, and especially as we hope to reverse the trend. We don't want to fast on Shavuos v'Tammuz. We don't want to fast on Tisha B'Av. We want to have a geula in every sense of the word. And the themes that are addressed in Parshas Korach are highly relevant to that situation. We know that Korach was a Baal Machlokes. Korach was somebody who caused fights and who started up fights. And I think it's legitimate within our first Aliyah plan to address the whole first part of the Parsha through the prism of the first Aliyah. Parsha begins, Vayikach Korach, that Korach took something, and the way Unkelus translates it, it's Ve'espelag, he created a division, he created a split, he created a machlokes. And Chazal also suggests that the language of Vayikach is also meant to suggest, a kinyan of some kind, that he made a purchase, and it was a bad purchase. It was a bad deal. Getting involved in machlokas is never going to work out well, and therefore the Torah is conveying that just with the first word of Vayikach Korach. It's also striking that we find his whole yichus here only to a certain point. The parasha begins, Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kohas ben Levi v'dasim v'aviram ben Eliyav. So to go back so many generations for Korach, ben Yitzhar ben Kohas ben Levi, and then it stops before Yaakov. So Chazal tell us, Rashi quotes, that this is because Yaakov davened, Yaakov asked that his name shouldn't be associated with Machlokas. So that's a very honorable request, but it's hard to understand how this helps. So we all know who Levi was, that he was the son of Yaakov. It's not hard to do the math and to figure out that this is a descendant of Yaakov. And in case you can't figure it out, you look in Divrei Hayamim, so there the Yichus is listed all the way back. So what exactly is accomplished by leaving Yaakov's name out here? And Rav Nosson Gestetner comments that the message that's being conveyed here is that sometimes people get involved in machlokas and they claim to be very noble, and they say they're not doing this for their own sake, they're not doing this for their own kavod, it's because of my father, it's because of my grandfather, it's because of my rabbi, it's because of whoever it is, I have to do it for his sake, I have to do it in order to stand up for the honor of somebody else, it's not me. So to that, Yaakov says, leave me out of it. I don't need to be invoked here. If you're going to get involved in a fight, please don't bring my name into the mix. So this role that Korach plays as the paradigmatic Baal Machlokes is one that seems to manifest itself in a specific Isser, as we find a little bit later in the parasha. It's not exactly in Rishon, but it builds on themes of Rishon, where we are told, after the story is over, that should not be like Korach and its people. And his people, this is later on in Parak Yitzayin, Pasuk Hei, towards the end of Shlishi, that there is this statement of not being like Korach. And while the context and the way a number of the Rishonim understand it, it sounds like this is more of a nevuah, or this is more of a statement about the future, and it may be referring to other aspects of what's going on. It is notable that the Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin, on Daf Kuf Yud, the Gemara says that this teaches us that kol hamachzik b'machlokes over b'lav, that whoever gives fuel and gives energy to a machlokes is in violation of a Torah prohibition. So that's how the Gemara at least represents it, even if some of the Rishonim don't read it that way. There are others who do. Some of the Moni HaMitzvahs do count this. And the Gemara has the statement that one who holds on to a machlokes is violating this Isser. And Rambam understands that it's an asmachta probably, because again, the context is a little bit different, but the emphasis Chazal give us is very crucial, and it's also both a positive and a negative statement, because first of all, it doesn't say whoever starts a machlokas. It says, kalamachzik b'machlokas, and as the commentaries point out, Tarat Tamima has a discussion, others talk about, this doesn't just mean whoever started it, but it means whoever gives it fuel, whoever gives it power, whoever holds on to it. And the contrast that we are supposed to emulate, Zalman Nechemia Goldberg had an article along these lines, and others emphasize that Moshe is the opposite, and that's what we're supposed to be like, that Moshe actively involved himself in trying to quiet the machlokas and in being mochel on his kavod in order to try to make things more harmonious, and that's the affirmative obligation that we have. So this is a very crucial concept, whether it's a lav from this pasuk or whether it comes to us from other sources. There's certainly a strong message here in our obligation not to continue machlokas and to do whatever we can to try to resolve the situation peacefully. Now, if we are told not to be like Korach, so we need to understand what exactly it is that typifies Korach's machlokas. And here the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos gives us a hint. The Mishnah contrasts a machlokas l'shem shamayim with a machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim. The Mishnah says that if you have a machlokas that is l'shem shamayim, sofo l'hiskayim, that's going to endure. And a machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim, sofo l'ibatel, that's not going to last. And cynically, the Kutzker Rebbe and a few others have commented that perhaps the message is that when you believe that a machlokas is l'shem shamayim, so then you're never going to drop it. It's going to go on forever. Sofo l'hiskayim, it's always going to be fought because you believe you're doing it for noble reasons. And when you recognize that machlokas is not l'shem shamayim, so then that machlokas can end. Sofo l'hibatel. So it's a sharp insight, and it's definitely true, but it's not really what the Mishnah is telling us, because the Mishnah clearly associates machlokas l'shem shamayim and enduring with the good possibility, and shelo l'shem shamayim and not enduring with the negative. So the good, the machlokas l'shem shamayim, the Mishnah tells us that's like Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. And the machlokas that is not l'shem shamayim, that is Korach v'Adaso. So here, if we take the prohibition of the Gemara in Sanhedrin together with the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, so we get a little bit more direction here, that essentially what we're told is we should not be like Korach, which means not to engage in a machlokes shelo l'shem shamayim. So still, there is a lot of subjectivity there. We have to figure out what exactly do we mean by a machlokes shelo l'shem shamayim. Many Mefarshim note, this is a very common observation you can find in the commentaries on Pirkei Avos, that there is a lack of parallelism in the Mishnah. That if we're talking about two sides, okay, when it comes to the machlokas l'shem shamayim, so then you have Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. As far as the bad machlokas, so it should say Korach v'Moshe, but instead it says Korach v'Adaso. So why is there this lack of parallelism in the Mishnah? Shouldn't it say the two sides? So some point out that this reflects the fact that Moshe was not involved. That Moshe did not perpetuate the machlokas himself. While others, the more common interpretation here, is that even within Korach's camp, you didn't have actual unity. You had an alliance. People got together on one side to pursue a common goal, but there wasn't actual shalom between them. So therefore, there's a split even internally. So it's Korach and his chevro, all of them were each pursuing their own ends. So therefore, it's appropriate to call it a machlokas even within that camp. And when you have people who are truly ba'achdus, so then that manifests itself in a very different way. So this is a little bit of insight into what we're talking about, that if we're saying not to be like Korach, so we're referring to a machlokas that is shelo l'shem shamayim, and that reflects itself a little bit in how people conduct themselves both with each other and with their Bali Plukta. Who are they arguing with? How do they relate to those people? So that's how some of the Mefarshim point out that if you are able to relate to the individual with whom you were arguing in a b'chavadik manner, and when you're not in the middle of the fight, so then you treat the person with a proper dignity and a proper spirit of yahav to l'reicha kamocha, so that's an indication of l'shem shamayim motive. While if it becomes personalized and you're not able to treat the other person properly, so that's an indication of a machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim. And that could be when the Mishnah says sofel hiskayim versus sofel hibatel. So it would seem like the Kutzker is right, that why is it a good thing sofel hiskayim? We don't want machlokas to go on forever. We want machlokas to end. So indeed, it's a good question. Why does the Mishnah say that the quality of a machlokas l'shem shamayim is that it's going to go on forever? It's a bad thing, you would think. So some of the Svarim explain that if you are talking about ideas and concepts, so then that's something for the ages. So then that's something that's worth recording in Shas and elsewhere, and it's something that's worth revisiting. But the Machlokas L'Shalom L'Shem Shamayim is based on external considerations, maybe on political advantage, or maybe on personal animosity, and that's not something that's worth recording for the generations, because it's not something that's connected to anything real, and therefore that's going to fall away. That's something that's not going to have any actual kiyum. So one way or another, we have this prohibition of acting like Korach, of being involved in Machlokas L'Shem Shamayim is good, Shelo L'Shem Shamayim is bad, and there is clearly a great challenge in being able to determine, even for ourselves, which one it is. Is it a machlokas l'shem shamayim, or is it a machlokas l'shem shamayim? It makes such a crucial difference. It takes a lot of objectivity and a lot of self-knowledge to know what it is you're taking on. And that perhaps connects to another concept here, which also relates to this identity of being a Korach type, of being a Bal Machlokas. And that is the fact that there is a halacha that the Yerushalmi has in the beginning of Peah. It's a halachos of Lashon Hara. There's no Masechtos Lashon Hara, but there are concentrations in Shas. So in the Bavli, if you look in the middle of Masechtos Erchin, it's where you find most of the comments about Hilchos Lashon Hara. But in the Yerushalmi, in the beginning of Maseches Peah, there's a lot of comments of relevance to Lashon Hara. And one of the dinim that you find there is that it's mutter ledaber Lashon Hara al bali machlokes. If somebody is a bal machlokes, you can speak Lashon Hara about him. So that halacha is very striking. It's a good question whether that's brought the halacha. Many of the Moni HaMitzvos don't bring that, but others do. So it's a little bit of a question what the authoritative nature of that statement is. The Chafetz Chaim does discuss it, but the Chafetz Chaim is very tentative about it. And he says, essentially, we have to be very limited in how you relate to this idea, that it's only for the purposes of quieting the machlokas, to whatever extent speaking Lashon Hara about the Bali machlokas will bring about peace. That's where you find this heter. And he's still very cautious, as we should not rush to label somebody a Bali machlokas. You have to be very careful in making that judgment. So it sounds like from the Chafetz Chaim that what we're talking about is a toeles based heter, that we know that Lashon Hara is mutter and sometimes required for a purpose, for a toelis that is recognized by halacha. So if that's the case, maybe that's what's going on here. Somebody's involved in machlokas. It's causing tremendous problems. It's both an avera and something that's inherently harmful. So therefore, in order to quiet the machlokas, it's mutter to speak Lashon Hara, but only to the extent that it furthers that toelis. Now, there are others who understand it more broadly, such as the Netziv and others, and they see it as a function of the Avera, that a Bal Machlokas was presumably a Avarian, somebody involved in Rishus, and therefore they shouldn't have the protection of Lashon Hara for that reason. So that would allow for a broader application. So why is the Chafetz Chaim so limited in how he applies this only when it serves the Toelis? So it seems, and I think the Chafetz Chaim himself explains this, that yes, it's true that there is a Aveira involved in being a Baal Machlokas, but it is a very unique kind of Aveira. It's a special kind of Aveira, because usually when somebody is involved in an Aveira, they have some idea that they're doing it. But when it comes to being a Baal Machlokas, very often the people are able to convince themselves that what they're doing is L'Shem Shemayim, what they're doing is necessary, and they don't perceive that it is an Aveira. So to that end, you have something here which in the Chafsa, so to speak, is an Aveira, but as far as the Gavra is concerned, as far as the one perpetrating it, he doesn't perceive or appreciate that it is an Aveira, and therefore the approach to such an individual is going to be much more targeted, as the Chafetz Chaim understands. It's also fascinating to note that the Chassam Sofer has a read on this where he adds a word, and it's very significant, gives a whole different dimension. The Chassam Sofer writes that it's mutter only one time in order to explain the status of the individual that you're talking about. And the way he puts it, he says, Baal Machlokes Shelo. So there the focus is not that this individual that you're talking about is a troublemaker by nature, is a contentious personality, but rather he is somebody who you are in a dispute with. And therefore, whoever you're talking to, you want to convey to them that this individual is somebody who has an issue with you, and maybe they're talking about you, and you need to be able to explain that there's a context, that there's an animosity that could be skewing things, that there is a bias. So therefore, there is a purpose to making that fact known in order to give a context to whatever is being said. So there is a lot to explore. He's shifting the focus of what we're talking about. We're not necessarily talking about an individual's general tendency, but about the fact that they has a animosity towards you. And it highlights the fact that that is going to color everything that is going to be said by this individual. So there is some value in being able to contextualize that and explain that to other individuals. It's also noteworthy, and this is something which we're justified in talking about from a first Aliyah perspective, because basically the border between the first Aliyah and the second Aliyah. So I think we can justify that in the end of the first Aliyah, so we have this hazmana that Moshe sends a invitation, so to speak, to Dasan Vaviram to come to Din, to come to resolve the issue. And they refuse. And this is where it spills over the border into the second Aliyah. So in the beginning of the second Aliyah, they have very strong language that is quoted in their refusal. It says, "Haine hanashim ahim tunaker lo nale. I don't care what you're going to do to us. You can gouge your eyes out. We're not going to come." They refuse to make an appearance. So that's a pretty strong expression. And apparently the Shliach Bezdin, the one who brought them this message, comes and reports that back to Moshe, and that's how it gets recorded in the Chumash. So if that's the case, so what do you see here? You see that the Gemara Moseches Moed Katan tells us that if a Shliach Bezdin is treated disrespectfully by whoever he's supposed to send the message to, that he's permitted to come and report that back to the Bezdin. That's not a violation of Lashon Hara. How do you see that? So here the commentaries explain, the Torah Tamima and others discuss, that apparently he reported it back to Moshe because that's how he knows what the statement was. And apparently Moshe is endorsing this, and God is endorsing this by the fact that it's included in the Torah, that we get their whole response that was reported back. That's a way of telling us that it was a legitimate thing to relate. There is a discussion, Torah Tamima and others try to figure out that there are a lot of things in the Chumash that Moshe did not himself witness. So Moshe had the direction from God to know what was going on that he didn't see and what to include. So maybe it's not necessarily the case that they came back and reported this to Moshe. But one way or another, the Gemara takes this as significant, that apparently it's mutter for the Shliach Beis Din to tell the Beis Din what was said to them, how they were treated. So here again, there's a lot of discussion as to what exactly this teaches us. And some raise the question that it should have been mutter anyway, because we just said a minute ago that if it's mutter to speak Lashon Hara about Bali Machlokes, so here Dasan and Aviram, they are the poster children for being Bali Machlokes. These are well-known troublemakers. And even if we take the Chafetz Chaim's advice that we're very, very careful how to assign this title and who to classify as a Baal Machlokes, still within history, you're not going to find many bigger Baali Machlokes than Dustin Baviram. If they're not Baali Machlokes, then nobody qualifies. So it would seem that that's certainly the case. If it's mutter to speak Lashon Hara about Baali Machlokes, so then how do we see from here that there's a heter for the Shliach Beis Din to relate what was said to him? Maybe it's just because he was dealing with Dasan and Aviram and they're not protected by Hilchos Lashon Hara in any event. So that's a question a number of the Achronim raised on this particular din. And there are a few approaches. Some say that really it's the same din. It's just two different ways of expressing the same idea. Others suggest that this goes to the Chafetz Chaim's point, that even within this heter for Bali Machlokes, it's still very limited and it's still very narrow and can only be invoked when it's going to help quiet the Machlokes. And maybe repeating the statement and highlighting their chutzpah is not really going to quiet the Machlokes, and therefore we need to explain that a different way. Or alternatively, maybe it's only to identify what exactly is going on here, who these characters are. And maybe that's the point. Like we said before, Dustin and Aviram, there's no question. Everyone knows they're the troublemakers. Everyone knows that they are the Bali HaMachlokes. So there wouldn't have been any additional toelis in referring to this incident specifically. And therefore, it must be that the heter is coming from someone else. The Shaul HaMeshiv, in his Shuvas, he makes a very important point, which reflects also part of what we've discussed about Lashon Hara in the past. And he comments that it's not just that they were reporting what was said, but that they also characterized it. And like we talked about a little bit in the context of Parshas Shlach and Parshas Baloscha, that the Isser Lashon Hara is not simply in relating facts, but it's also, or maybe specifically, in how you characterize it and how you spin it. And that's where the Lashon Hara would have been. And that's why apparently it was mutter, because you're dealing with a Shliach Beis Din. So this is a instructive halacha in and of itself. And it's interesting, this is invoked in other contexts. There is a shaila that's discussed by Poskim. Let's say you have a toelis situation. Let's say, for example, you are the principal of a school and you have a student who has issues of whatever type, and you want to communicate that to the parents. And that's the toelis, that the parents should be able to help with the chinuch of the child. And you want to send them a letter. So in order to send them a letter, you're going to ask the secretary to write up the letter and to send it to them. So is there any heter for that to involve a third party here, somebody who wouldn't have necessarily known about what was going on? Maybe we should say the principal has to write the letter himself, has to type the letter himself. What's the justification to get a third party involved? So Tzitz Eliezer has a tshuva about this, where he talks about related issues and many other contexts you can imagine where there's a organizational structure dealing with some kind of sensitive information, whether it's negative information or private information. And the question of allowing a third party, an assistant of some kind, to be involved in communicating the information. So that question is dealt with. And Tzitz Eliezer was inclined to say that this should be permitted because that's the nature of the system. That's what's required for the system to function. And we understand that that's how it's necessary in order to operate. We understand that that's how the system is going to function. And so, for example, when you send your children to school, so you understand that's how the school functions, that the principal needs an assistant in order to be able to carry out his tasks. And in other such contexts also, and it's all one system, it's all Yad Achas, and therefore he thought it was permissible. However, not everyone was so convinced. Rabbi Yoshev, for example, was more machmir about this. He was talking about a situation where you have medical school trainees, if I remember correctly, and there was a need to write evaluations. And the one who was doing the evaluating, so if he wants to have his assistant fill out or type up the evaluations, Rabbi Yoshev thought that was a big problem, that there wasn't a heter to involve somebody else in the process. And his son-in-law, Rav Zilberstein, records that he asked him that maybe it's an Eitzah to have the assistant type up the whole text, but not to have the names. And then the actual evaluator, he can come in afterwards and he can fill in the names. And he thought, no, even that wasn't acceptable, that was a violation of Lashon Hara too, because they'll be able to figure it out and they have to do the whole thing themselves. But again, there are many who assume that this is justified functionality, like the Tzitz Eliezer and also Rav Huttner. So Rav Huttner has a letter in which he quotes this din that we were talking about from our parsha, that the Shliach Bezdin is allowed to relate back to the Bezdin what was said. This is the reason he's allowed to do that, is because that's the way systems work. Whenever you have an organizational system, what this din is telling us is it's not specific to the Shliach Bezdin, and it's not specific to the Russia possibility of a Baal Machlokas. It's a statement about organizational structures, that when you have a system, it needs a number of people involved in order for it to function. So it's legitimate toelis to involve the functionaries of the organization to accomplish their goals and to accomplish their justified needs, and that's not a violation of Lashon Hara. One way or another, our parsha is very relevant to our tekufa right now, that as we approach the 3 weeks and we're hoping to change course before we get to the fast of Shavuot B'Tammuz, so it's very crucial to recognize just how much of a machlokas Ol Hashem Shamayim we sometimes find ourselves drawn to, and to recognize the tremendous harm that takes place. So we find in the parsha that there is this broad consequence involving entire families, and Chazal have a statement that you see kamakasha onshin shel machlokas, you see how hard machlokas is and what it brings about, that even infants, even very young children, end up getting punished. And of course, a question presents itself: if you're not a bardas, if you're only an infant, how can you be liable to be punished for anything? And what Chazal seem to be telling us is it's just a reflection of the reality that when you have machlokas, it has such a broad impact and it has such widespread effect that those who have no guilt whatsoever and who have no ability to have any guilt whatsoever are also swept up in its consequences, and it's tremendously harmful. And here we find that for so many centuries we're still paying the price of machlokas. And I say that specifically because Rav Achaigon, in his Shiltos, so he understands that this prohibition of creating a machlokas, which he does record, this prohibition of being like Korach, is because when you're involved in machlokas, so then you come to hate the other person. You could reach the Isser of Loisisna Sachicha Bilvavecha. And we've spoken about a number of times this year, so here it's again a fitting bookend to some of our discussions of the concept of a siag d'oraisa. You recall we talked about that in the context of basar b'chalav and chametz and many other related ideas. So it seems like here's another item to add to the list. Reuven Margolius and his sefer Margolius Ayam on the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So he discusses this comment of the Shiltos, and he says what you seem to have here is a siag d'oraisa, that the real iser is sinna, that we're not supposed to hate each other, and if we get involved in a machlokas, so then that could lead to sinna. And of course, especially if it's a machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim, so that's what we saw. One of the key indicators that it's a machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim is that it becomes personalized, and that indeed it could bring about this idea of sinna. So when it comes to our galus, comes to our exiles, so we know that Chazal tell us that the cause of the churban bayisheni, the churban that we're still in the middle of, is because of sinas chinam, is because of unjustified hatred. And here there's a direct line that's being drawn between engaging in machlokes shelo l'shem shamayim, and sinna, as the Shiltas is telling us. So if we really do hope to finally have some success in reversing this trend, in taking us out of this gullus that has lasted so many centuries, we haven't been successful so far. So certainly we have to worry about sinas chinam, but maybe we need to also build up higher fences. We need to take on even greater protections in order to make sure that we will avoid that sinna. And that's going to require paying more attention to all the steps along the way. So if machlokas is indeed a path to such attitude, so we have to go to even greater lengths to avoid machlokas shelo l'shem shamayim, anything that could seem to connect to that in any way. And hopefully in the schus of such genuine achdus, we should reach the situation of redemption from all of our current troubles, and we should soon see a full geula b'mehei Rabbi Yameinu. So I want to thank you very much for a very enjoyable Junesman. I believe that, or I think I'd like to continue the Parsha Shirim throughout the summer, so I'll send you out some notifications about that, so we should be able to stay in touch. And you see the yeshiva is offering many limudim throughout July and throughout the summer, so hopefully we'll find ways to continue the yeshiva experience throughout. And one way or another, I look forward to seeing you soon. So I wish you all a safe and healthy Shabbos and a safe and healthy weeks ahead. And we should be connected in all of the inspirational ways. So thank you so much, and I will see you soon.
Man, thank you.
Thank you.